from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
This is the most complicated takeover, not only on the planet, but in history.
First of all, it's rigged. And I'm afraid the election's going to be rigged, I have to be honest.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
You know what we call a person like that? You know, the screamers, the yellers, the people who try to intimidate you. You know what we call a person like that in Pittsburgh? A jagoff.
That's some of the week's news out of context. It is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. And save your comments. We'll be talking about the etymology of that particular Pittsburgh term in just a couple minutes. First of all, I want to welcome in Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello once again, Colin.
I just so didn't know we could say jagoff on this show.
No, I'll explain.
Completely, I have to change my whole strategy.
It doesn't mean what you think it means. Mark Pazniokas is here, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Paz.
Hi, I'm just absorbing that intro.
And also with us today from the studios of Yale University is Kalila Brown-Dean. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Kalila, always good to hear from you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Republican nominee Donald Trump is getting a barrage of criticism over his remarks concerning the family of a fallen U.S. Army captain. Gold Star Father Kazir Khan criticized Trump during his speech at the Democratic National Convention last week.
Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing and no one.
Trump responded to Khan's remarks in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
How would you answer that, Father? What sacrifice have you made for your country?
I think I've made a lot of sacrifices. I work very, very hard. I've created thousands and thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs. I think
those are sacrifices?
Oh, sure, I think they're sacrifices. I think when I can employ thousands and thousands of people, take care of their education, take care of so many things, even in military, I mean, I was very responsible, along with a group of people, for getting the Vietnam Memorial built in downtown Manhattan, which to this day people thank me for. I raised and I have raised millions of dollars for the vets. I'm helping the vets a lot.
Okay, so that's some of how Trump reacted. But the big part that we want to talk about how he reacted, Colin, was some of the things that he said about Kazir Khan and his wife standing there silently on stage. Too emotional, in her words, to talk. He lashed out at her. And then as the criticism rolled in, he continued to lash out. Just yesterday, two of those Republicans who have fired back at him, John McCain and House Speaker Paul Ryan, he decided to say to The Washington Post, not so sure I'm going to endorse them in November. I'm not necessarily sure that we've seen anything quite like this. We've said this often during this political season, but up until this point, almost nothing that Trump has said has slowed his momentum. Almost nothing he has said has made his poll numbers go down. And this seems to be the thing that has done just that.
Yeah, although I will say that there have been other occasions where his poll numbers went down because of his behavior. The Judge Curiel incident probably is the most recent one that falls into that category. So how is this a little bit different from Judge Curiel, from unkind things he said about Heidi Cruz, or for that matter, Ted Cruz's father? I mean, we just could compile this incredibly long list. There's a couple of ways in which this is different, and many of my observations here are going to be highly unoriginal. But one difference between the Khan family and Judge Curiel is that Judge Curiel is a federal judge. His responses are somewhat circumscribed. There are limits to what he can say back. The cons are not under those kinds of prescriptions. And as a result, I mean, they've been able to keep this story alive to whatever degree they want to. But I think the other thing you're seeing here is it's a little bit like, you know, I think maybe we've all at one point or other been at a bar or something with our friend who just wants to keep going back to somebody who's trying to pick a fight with them, and you're there going, Bobby, let it go. Come on, we're having a nice evening, Bobby. You know, just forget about that guy. He's a jagoff. Leave him alone. So that clearly is what Trump's aides are doing with him right now, saying, just let this go. And he can't do it. And when we get into that question of temperament and the kinds of things that President Obama was saying yesterday about whether this guy is fit to be president, he seems to not be in control of his behavior. He seems not to be able to assess the upside and the downside of something and err on the side of the upside. I mean, the downside to everything he's doing is so gigantic by any rational calculation. But he's not able either to perceive that or act on those perceptions. And that really does raise some questions about whether he has the psychological balance, whether he's solid enough to lead the United States through, you know, much more critical situations than a bereaved father and mother kind of, you know, getting in his face.
Well, and Kalila, I think part of the key to this is what he and his surrogates continue to say is that, well, he was lashed out at. He is allowed to lash back. It seems as though there were certain people in America that no matter what they said, you'd be hard-pressed if you were a politician to then say something disparaging about them. Gold Star families fit very tightly into that category, but we seem to have broken new ground here.
Well, it raises this question throughout this campaign: what is sacred in American civil society? And even if you don't agree with the family's political views, you cannot dispute their pain. So to hear Trump talk about what he sacrificed, well, he's also gained a lot from that sacrifice. This family has gotten nothing more than a lapel pin, a beautiful American flag, and hate mail from Trump supporters. So I think now is the time for those people to say, look, certain things are off limits. And even if a private citizen decides to critique a public official, you then don't go back at them. That's a basic standard. You wouldn't do it in business. You certainly don't do it at this level of politics.
And I think part of the argument, too, that Trump was making, Kalila, is this notion, and maybe these were just poorly chosen words, and he didn't mean to say this exactly the way he did, but he said that essentially Khan doesn't have the right to do what he did. And many people have come back and said, no, that's exactly what being an American is all about. You have just that right to stand up, especially if you feel aggrieved or you feel hurt or you feel as though somehow you need to say something. You can. That's like what the First Amendment's all about.
You not only have the right, you have the obligation. And so I've heard so much this campaign cycle about the Second Amendment. We need to protect the Second Amendment. We need to affirm this. This is an absolute right. Why are we so willing to concede on the First Amendment? That family suffered a tremendous loss, and they felt they needed to tell their son's story in their own words and on their own terms. We then don't get to bash that because we don't like the content or we don't like the message.
The Republican convention had an analogous moment, and the aftermath was very different because of the way Hillary Clinton and the Democrats reacted. Patricia Smith, the mother of Sean Smith, who was one of the four Americans killed at the diplomatic compound in Benghazi, it was a chilling moment in the hall, and I think if you're watching it on TV, I mean, this woman was bereft. She said, "I blame Hillary Clinton. I blame Hillary Clinton personally for the death of my son." And, you know, again, it was one of those moments that hit you in the gut, and nobody pushed back at her because this was a woman who's grieving. There are people who look at the fine points of to what extent some of the criticism at Clinton is fair or accurate. But again, there was no pushback. You know, that's the thing. I mean, you know, Colin, I thought, had the key point here. There's the decency question, but the larger question is Mr. Trump's fitness, his temperament, the idea that when everyone around you, your children, your advisors, I mean, Chris Christie, who has been like a puppy dog after Mr. Trump for months, Chris Christie could not separate himself fast enough from Trump when it came to this.
Yeah, and of course, as some internet memes have showed, Chris Christie also stood famously next to Donald Trump, doe-eyed, looking up at him, not saying a blessed word during that initial press conference, seemingly making people wonder why Christie was not allowed to speak, Colin.
Yeah, I just want to go back to a couple of things about this. First of all, I mean, campaigns are about fixing what's wrong, right? It's like, You know, you sort of need R2-D2, you know, in the original Star Wars movie, something springs loose and R2-D2 locks it back down. So when things break, you fix them. And this campaign isn't running that right way, right? I mean, things break and they just stay broken because Trump has no interest in fixing them. He doesn't want to correct his course. And so the right thing to do here, obviously, is to table this, you know, and walk away. And he can't seem to do that. And that's a huge liability. I mean, it probably means he can't fix other things. Another thing is in the Republican convention and in the ads that wrapped around the Republican convention, there's that Hillary Clinton ad that has the little children watching television and Trump is like doing all this weird stuff. One of the things that's in that ad, and it's something that also came up at least once in the Democratic convention, and maybe more than once, is the moment where Trump made fun of the reporter with the motor disability. And I just know from the way that this has been using that they focus grouped that. And the focus groups, their jaws are just hanging open, the idea that he would make fun of somebody's physical disability, and that the Clinton campaign thinks if more people know about that, it's really going to hurt him. We've got to get that story in front of more people. More people need to know about it. And Trump is just making more of these kinds of stories. The con story is a very similar kind of story. You're making fun of or pushing back at or dissing somebody that you really ought not to diss. I will put one caveat on all this, which is a lot of the things that we've described here and that you described in the run-up to this are things that isolate Trump, right? The more that Ryan backs away from him or McCain backs away from him, he gets more and more isolated. You've got the president pushing back in a way that incumbent presidents typically don't push back at the other party's nominee. But Trump's whole campaign these days is about being isolated, about making himself this messianic figure who can address defects in the system that are bipartisan and that he is the only person capable of addressing. So in some ways, this fits his narrative. I don't know how mass market a narrative that can be. I don't know whether you can win an election with this, with a narrative that says, I don't need anybody. I don't want anybody. The more people who condemn me, the better. It just proves I'm the only person who's right.
But you wonder if we're not building to a moment that we saw in 1964 where Barry Goldwater's slogan was, in your heart, you know he's right. And the Democrats eventually came back with, in your guts, you know he's nuts. And and there is that vibe. I mean, to have the president of the United States questioning the mental fitness of a major party candidate for office is extraordinary.
But and Kalila, this is something that I've been trying to figure out myself and what exactly the appeal is. As Colin rightly says, Trump is trying to place himself as the type of candidate who not only doesn't care about the support of John McCain or the president of the United States, but actually is actively courting their disapproval because he feels as though it can activate a certain part of his base. In some communication that I've had with some Trump supporters over the course of this week, I've learned a little bit of something about the base in which they say there literally is no line. There's nothing that he could do, making fun of somebody with a disability, making fun of someone who has lost a family member, that would not make them like him more. That is indeed something that's very, very different. It may go against any of the sense of decency that many of us have, but it does seem to activate a pretty large percentage of the American public right now.
I think this election has ripped off a scab in American society so that even if we removed Donald Trump from the election as sort of the figurehead for this, it is tapping into some type of anger and angst in the American public that I think we have to address. And what I often hear from people who support Trump is he's not about political correctness. And I think that's the problem. We conflate political correctness with basic respect and civility. And what happens in these discussions is that we start pitting victims and victims' pain against one another. So that if you have Ambassador Chris Stevens' family saying, I don't blame Hillary Clinton, don't bring us into this, don't use our loss for your political chess match, then you have a family saying something different, then the public is, well, they're not right. They don't get to decide this. You have Eric Garner's mother on stage at the DNC. You have Tamir Rice's mother saying, Barack Obama, the Democrats have done nothing for my family. I refuse to engage in this. And so the collateral damage of all of this discussion is that we're still not addressing the pain that these families feel, or even the collective understanding that we all have about the real policy implications.
Kyle, I'd like you to maybe have a comment here on this that we got from Cecile on Facebook. More than anything, I'm gravely concerned by Trump's scorched earth tactics, the words scorched earth in all caps. What will happen November 9th? Win or lose? How will this man get his followers to accept election results or transfer to governing? If the results are close, and they will be, how are we ever going to get this cat back in the bag?
So we've already heard it, right? We've heard Donald Trump say that everyone from the NFL to the DNC is colluding together to make the results of this campaign or this election something different from what people have. I don't think it's going to be an easy win. I, at this point, I believe if Donald Trump stayed silent between now and the election, his supporters would still go out and vote for him and see that as some sort of, you know, patriotic way of contesting the system. So probably the only thing Trump and I really agree on is that I fear how this election will be rigged. But the fear I had was that Supreme Court decision striking down parts of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So I don't think Trump supporters will get on board. We may end up where we were in 2000 after Bush v. Gore.
Or we may end up in a much more venomous version of 2008, where some people had problems with the legitimacy of Barack Obama. One of those people, of course, was Donald Trump. But yeah, Jamelle Bouie has a piece about this in Slate magazine today, just saying, yeah, each outcome has some real problems. Trump winning is a little bit scary or very scary, but Trump losing is also a problem. Let's say 130 million people vote, and let's say 50 million people vote for Donald Trump. You know, a lot of those people, as Kalila is saying, are not going to just lay down their weapons and walk away. And we know that Trump is not going to do the Tom Foley thing. Remember, there was a point in that contested Tom Foley, Dan Malloy election where Foley finally said, okay, fair and square, he beat me, I'm walking away, he's the governor. And we know, we just know temperamentally that Trump will not do that, that he will say, this is rigged, this was wrong, the Clintons have stolen another thing. He will set a tone going into the first term of a Hillary Clinton presidency where everything about her is being questioned at the level of basic legitimacy.
You're right. Al Gore in 2000, Tom Foley in Connecticut in 2010, took the larger view. They looked beyond themselves and they looked at what was good for their country and their state. And they said, do not question the legitimacy of the man who was just elected. I think Colin's right. This is going to be closer to 2008, where there will be questions about Hillary Clinton's legitimacy if indeed she is elected. But I guess in other ways, it's going to be a continuation of where we are. We have been a 50-50 country for quite a while now, and it looks like we'll be living with that for the foreseeable future.
One quick phone call. David's in Woodbury. Hi, David.
Oh, hi. Hi, John and everybody. Donald Trump, where do you start? But let's say with foreign policy, he wanted the Russians to hack into Hillary's 30,000 emails, please. And what's dangerous about his wanting to withdraw from NATO? It's inviting Russia to ease them way into the Baltic states, which they very much would like to have. Russia, I mean Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. I would be terrified with him as president.
Well, hey, David, thank you very much for your phone call. Kalila, a quick response to this. I mean, we talked a little bit on the show in past weeks about, you know, Trump's flirtations with Vladimir Putin, about whether or not there is a direct connection between the Trump campaign and the Ukraine. And these are all things that have somebody like David worried when he says, you know, maybe we're not going to be part of NATO. That, in a very unstable world, is something that has a lot of people scared.
Well, I think what makes me afraid as well is, you know, if the DNC did something wrong, they should be held accountable. And it should be more than just voluntary separations. But it scares me as an American citizen that we're applauding another country interfering with our political process. If we are willing to go to war, if we are willing to put our service members at risk in order to establish democracy abroad, we need to think about protecting it here at home. And that is regardless of political party, regardless of ideology. So, you know, to sort of paraphrase Barack Obama, don't be afraid, vote. And encourage your friends to register and participate and vote the way that they see fit.
To David's call, I was thinking, oh, that was so last week. We're not talking about that anymore. We're talking about the baby who got kicked out of the rally, and we're talking about the Khan family. I mean, Trump produces so much of this stuff that one thought tends to drive out another. There's just an incredible amount of this. And the other thing that he produces a lot of is inaccurate statements about things like foreign policy. So the stuff that Dave was talking about, of course, was followed up by another interview in which it seemed unclear whether he understood the nature of Russian incursions into Crimea. You know, if we think back, not to sound really old, but where Gerry Ford famously in that debate, having, I think, what was more of like a brain fart than a real kind of failure to understand the situation, but it sounded like he didn't understand the Soviet presence in Eastern Europe. And he couldn't live it down, right? I mean, he couldn't shake that off. He just sounded so dumb at that one moment, making this kind of glaringly wrong statement. But Trump makes these glaringly wrong statements that suggest a completely faulty apprehension of the basic facts of geopolitics all the time, and nobody seems to care.
Well, I just want to quickly get a comment from you, Paz, on this, though. I think one of the things that Kalila is bringing up is really interesting. For years, America has tried to export democracy into other parts of the world with varying degrees of success, let's just say. And one of the great failures, perhaps, of the Bush administration was thinking that we could take over countries like Iraq and Afghanistan and employ democratic principles in a place that where they haven't previously taken root. But that came from a basic premise that American democracy is a functional thing that other people will like. Trump seems to be coming at this from a place where American democracy is broken, we're rigging elections, and we can't even do things abroad that other people would want to emulate. I mean, that is a very different view of America and how we might project ourselves for good or ill than any certainly Republican or Democrat or any politician I know has ever conceived of.
He also has appropriated America first. The nativist cry of the months and years leading up to World War II, you know, it's hard. You know, he either did that out of complete ignorance or he is signaling something. So, I mean, this is a guy who's an isolationist who has indicated he would give Putin a lot of room to move in the Ukraine and in Crimea. Paul Manafort, his campaign chairman, one of his former consulting clients was the deposed Ukrainian leader who had to take shelter in Russia. I mean, you know, any of these things by themselves in another time, you know, a long ago times like 4 years ago would have been fatal, would have been a scandal. For whatever reason, it's just the drumbeat.
When we come back from our break, we're going to talk about the fact that there are third-party candidates in this race. Maybe, just maybe, they might have some sort of an influence here. Also, a look at whether or not Connecticut is in play. We're going to take a look at the glass ceiling that Hillary Clinton broke after accepting the party's nomination. And we'll also hear from you at 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, taking a look at the week's news with Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. She joins us today from the studios of Yale University in lovely New Haven, Connecticut. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. And with us, as always, is Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Hey, Colin, what's in your show this week or this night?
This night. We are going to talk about the Olympics. First of all, some of the sort of really basic questions about the Olympics. Olympics. Does it ever help a host city or host country to host the Olympics? We'll also talk about some of the controversies. And then at the end, we're going to talk to a guy named Devin McEwen. He's a whitewater slalom canoeist. And he's like the most – I already talked to him. He's like the most mellow – he's Sandra Boynton's son, among other things.
And really?
And his father was also a whitewater meddling slalom canoeist, died two years ago of multiple myeloma. And Devin has now qualified for the Olympics in the same event. So it's a pretty nice story. He's just so mellow. I mean, he's just like not worried, you know.
So we'll hear about the Olympics this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. Very quickly, before we move on to some other things, you mentioned this in the first segment. We were talking about such weighty topics. I didn't want to really bring it back to this. But Donald Trump kicked a baby out of a rally. Let's just let that sink in for a second. We had a crying baby, and he decided, Colin, that was just way too much for him.
Yeah, and, you know, I think we're going to be talking about a Kalilah's piece about gender stereotypes. I was wondering what would happen if Hillary Clinton kicked a baby out of a rally. I think we kind of know how that would play out in various parts of Fox News and stuff like that. And, yeah, once again, this is this kind of thing where, you know, do you have the – there's like a counter. There's a clicking counter that runs in most people's heads, right? It's going, yeah, baby's there. Okay, I probably can't really say anything too bad about the baby. Got to deal with the baby. Hope the baby goes away. He just doesn't have that. You know, that little thing that clicks away in our heads most of the time and kind of keeps us from doing things that are really going to bounce back against us. He doesn't have that little mechanism because really you don't kick babies out of rallies. Or you wait for your staff to go find the baby and walk into the back of the room. You don't have to kick the baby out of the rally.
Hillary Clinton, of course, has made history by becoming the first female presidential nominee of a major party. But will her success change gender stereotypes in politics? Now, here's a little bit from Clinton's surprise satellite appearance last week at the DNC.
Hello, Philadelphia. I am so happy. It's been a great day and night. What an incredible honor that you have given me. And I can't believe we just put the biggest crack in that glass ceiling yet. Thanks to you and to everyone who's fought so hard to make this possible. This is really your victory. This is really your night. And if there are any little girls out there who stayed up late to watch, let me just say, I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next. Thank you all. I can't wait to join you in Philadelphia. Thank you.
And again, that was from the night before Hillary Clinton gave her acceptance speech. Kalilah, you've written about this week, and part of the context, I think, for all this is back in 2008, we were talking about whether or not Barack Obama being named the first African-American president of the United States was going to usher in a post-racial era. I think it's fair to say that we have not gotten anywhere close to that. A question on many people's minds is this a post-gender era? Do we not worry anymore about the role of women in society, given that we may well have a woman president?
So I really tried to make sense of the political moment of last week, having the first woman to receive a major party nomination. And there were two things that anchored my thinking around that. One was Shirley Chisholm when she sought the Democratic nomination in 1973. And what she said was that we make such a big deal about my gender and about my race seems silly in a democratic society. But the fact that she was the first woman to reach that level in Congress, the first woman to pursue that nomination, proved, according to Chisholm, that we weren't yet just nor free. And then last week to have a woman that was 102 years old and a delegate to the DNC to think that for the first 6 years of her life, women weren't even allowed to vote. And so that sort of framed for me why we needed to look at the Clinton historical moment as not just a moment, but part of this larger context. And the point I make in the piece is simply Hillary Clinton is an outlier, not just for women running for office, but indeed for most people running for public office in our country, whether it's name recognition, being in public affairs for so long, being able to raise so much money. I think the danger of seeing this as a post-gender moment is that what we saw after Barack Obama rose to national prominence is not post-racial, but really hyper-racial moment, whether it was attacks on him and his family or the types of policy backlash, the campaigns that we're seeing right now. So I wanted to, you know, I'm a data numbers nerd, put some context into the bump that we received in terms of more people of color running for office was actually quite minimal since 2008.
One thing that is different just in terms of the numbers, though, Kalila, is that even with the enormous support that Barack Obama got from African Americans during both of his elections, that is a smaller part of the population than the segment of the population that is female. I mean, if women turn out to vote either because they think Hillary Clinton could be a great president or because they want to vote for the first woman president ever or because the things that Donald Trump says about women or the things that he holds dear seemingly are anathema to many women, those are all reasons why women could have a real outsized influence here. Is there something different perhaps about this moment because of just how powerful women are in electoral politics versus this sort of post-racial question that Barack Obama was facing?
Well, it raises the question of why. So that if women are 51% or 52% of voters in this country, why do they still make such a small percentage of people in state legislatures and in national office? What I think is unique about this Hillary Clinton candidacy that we did not see with Barack Obama in 2008 or even 2012 is that Clinton's candidacy will motivate a lot of women to pursue public office across the political spectrum. So you may be a conservative Republican woman who says, yes, I'm a woman, but that doesn't define my policy issues in the way of a Hillary Clinton. So I want to be like a Joni Ernst and run as a conservative mother, U.S. Veteran, and make it very clear that I have conservative views and I'm just as much a woman candidate as anyone else. So I think that will have a broader effect given the number of women in this country and women who want to say we're not a monolithic group in our political views, much the same way that African Americans have moved as well.
You know, I feel, you know, bad cases make bad law. In some ways, I feel in the case of Hillary Clinton's bad candidates make bad models and bad precedent. And I'm thrilled that there's a woman running for president as a major party nominee. I wish it wasn't Hillary Clinton. I think she comes with so much baggage. And for a lot of people, including a lot of women who've waited for this moment, this seems like the restoration of the American Perones as opposed to a woman pursuing this, you know, in the way that we kind of want it to be. And I just, you know, I feel as though it's a struggle. Reading Kalila's piece, and I thought it was a terrific piece and very provocative and made me think about a lot of things. But so much of our effort now, Kalila, is to separate the things that are legitimate questions from the things that are over-tinctured by considerations of gender. And like one of the things that I flagged in your piece, because I see it differently than you do, at the end you sort of said, near the end you say that she gets defined as a hawk the way that Madeleine Albright and Margaret Thatcher got defined as hawks because women aren't supposed to be so aggressive. I mean, the problem is that Hillary Clinton is a hawk, and for her entire time in the Obama presidency, she was pushing him towards more militarism, towards more shows of force. I assume that when she's president, and I hope she gets to be president, I hope like anything she gets to be president, but that she will be militaristic in a way that I find uncomfortable, and she will certainly be more interventionist, more willing to give the military anything it asks for than Barack Obama ever was. He has been kind of the cool head and the cool hand about all this. And I don't think any of my feelings about this have anything to do with her gender. I just watched what her behavior has been so far, and that's what I see.
But I think it also is for many people uncomfortable because we do have the expectation that women are supposed to be the more even keel. They are supposed to be the ones who are encouraging a president to think about, well, no, let's not go with military intervention. Let's see if we can find an alternate route. So that when someone pursues a strategy that is not that, it raises a flag. So you asked the question in the last segment, what if Hillary Clinton had kicked the baby out of the room? That would be a death knell for her. Public expectation is that she would have picked the baby up from the mother and had this beautiful moment where she said, oh, it reminds me of raising Chelsea or spending time with my grandchildren. So I think a lot of people would want to see her with the baby on one hip and the microphone in the other, continuing on with that political speech.
Paz?
You know, one thing that we have ignored is the fact she's married to Bill Clinton. So that alone makes her an imperfect groundbreaker. She starts off with huge advantages that, unfortunately, to use her as a pioneer in the women's movement, she is to a degree, not entirely, but to a degree, an outgrowth of her husband's career. Now, clearly, she's a very accomplished woman. well-educated, has built her own career. But it's going to be hard when you step back and look at this as a moment in history. It's going to be hard to separate that she was a first lady and that she did come to prominence by being married to a president of the United States.
An outgrowth of her husband's career, perhaps, Paz, but I'd like a quick comment from you, Kalila, about an outgrowth of the career of someone who has such, let's just say, complicated relationships with the female electorate. I mean, Bill Clinton has been part of American society for quite some time, and one of the things that we will all remember about him is some of what he did while he was in office, including wagging his finger, saying, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," while he was in the midst of an affair with a White House intern. These are the sorts of things, unfortunately, that have to follow around Hillary Clinton. That she'll never be able to live down. She's probably a unique character in American politics because of that. But I don't know how we factor in the Bill Clinton thing when we talk about Hillary Clinton as a woman and as a presidential candidate.
So for me, reading the social media reactions to Bill Clinton's speech made it very clear of, you know, just how heavy that baggage is for her. Because there are still people who feel resentment toward Hillary Clinton. Why did you stay with him? Why did you defend his bad behavior? And that's whether we're talking about Monica Lewinsky or the 1994 crime bill, of people wanting her to answer to that and to pay for that. But to the idea of having a perfect archetype of a candidate, you know, I heard that in 2008 with people questioning Barack Obama. Is he really black enough to be the first African-American president? He's biracial. He was raised by a black mother. He doesn't have that sort of traditional experience of black politics in this country. Is he the person that you want to put forth as that representative? And I think time will tell in terms of what this will mean for not just little girls, but for young boys as well, to see what's possible so that we can critique people and have, you know, problems with them, and we should. I think she's a very problematic political figure and candidate, but it does not take away from what this means for the possibility in our country and in our democracy.
You mean we can critique people without wholesale vilifying them? Oh, I didn't realize that was possible in American politics today.
It's nice to have a reminder, and I'll just say that, you know, the backlash and hate mail that I have received, not because of the piece, but just the title. You know, and I finally said to a person yesterday, "Did you even read the article? Because nothing that you're accusing me of is within the piece." So the way that we can have disagreements and that public discourse that has been so compromised by our current tenor.
Well, one of the other things that Hillary Clinton had to deal with last week is that she was accepting this nomination as she was in the midst of this historic moment. She often, during her acceptance speech, had to talk loudly over people who were Bernie Sanders supporters who were chanting things that were trying to throw her off her game. And now the Democratic nomination is set in stone. Bernie Sanders has thrown his support behind Hillary Clinton. A lot of Bernie Sanders supporters, Paz, have to wonder, what are they going to do right now? You talked to an awful lot of them. You've written about this. I mean, where do the Sanders people go post-convention?
The interesting thing to me was how the ones I talked to seem more committed to working within the Democratic Party. They still have varied opinions about Hillary Clinton. There were a couple who left no doubt in my mind that if Connecticut is a safe state for Hillary Clinton, they will be casting a vote for Jill Stein or someone else. But I think the more important political factor, and this is what the Democrats are eager to capture, is the idea that you do have some new people who have come into politics and they want to keep playing. They want to keep being a factor. Most of the Sanders delegates from Connecticut, I think, will be voting for Hillary Clinton. You have a mix. You have some who are institutional Democrats who just happen to like Bernie Sanders' policies, and for them it's an easy call, you know, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. But for the newcomers, I think it is a more complicated question. But again, the first cut at it, you know, the folks I talk to, is they're going to stay involved. They're not walking away. And that for the Democrats is probably the best story.
I think what I want to see are numbers, and numbers that are stable. So this is a really bad time to look at polls. The 538 guys say, wait about 3 weeks from here. And then you'll sort of see, obviously, you can't rely on numbers that include a bounce because a bounce is a fundamentally unstable concept. So 3 weeks from now, I want to look at some polls, a whole bunch of polls, and sort of see what happened. We should be able, using crosstabs, to see what actually did happen with the Bernie Sanders people, what they're going to do. A lot of it probably does depend on how safe their state feels, although at some point I hope we talk about the illusion of a safe state in an election like this one. And probably a lot of it will depend on how well the message of the other candidates, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, reach them.
Well, could you talk about that very quickly, though? I mean, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein have to get on the ballots. We actually have heard a little bit from these candidates. We might assume that there are an awful lot of Republicans who are dissatisfied with Donald Trump, who might flock to the Libertarian, a bunch of Bernie Sanders supporters who might flock to the Green Party candidate. But it's not that simple, Colin.
Right. So August 10th is the petitioning date here, deadline here in Connecticut. Gary Johnson's people keep saying he's going to be on 48 out of 50 ballots. I assume Connecticut is one of those 48 states, although if you look on the Libertarian website right now, I haven't heard anything about it out of the Secretary of State's office. They tend not to tell us until the last minute. But they actually show on their own website Connecticut is not being a resolved question. It's one of the ones that they don't feel is all the way in the barn. I feel like that's wrong somehow, that Johnson will be on the ballot. Stein may have a little bit more of a problem. She also has that as kind of a blinking light on her website, Connecticut getting on the ballot, collecting the right number of signatures. We do know from the scant polling we have about Connecticut that when you put them into the race, it tightens up the race. So that's something. I mean, I think Clinton's margin went from a 7 to a 5 or something as a result of having them in the race. So it doesn't tighten the race up that much, but it does. It does have an effect.
Kalila?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at the key battleground states in this race, and they also happen to be the states that have the highest standards for getting onto the ballot as a third-party candidate. So what that will mean, not just for the national level, but some of these down-ticket races as well, will people still come out?
Very quickly, Kalila, U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down North Carolina's voter ID law last week, citing racially discriminatory intent. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Diana Motz wrote, "We cannot ignore the record evidence that because of race, the legislature enacted one of the largest restrictions of the franchise in modern North Carolina history."
I think it's a major decision that is a very high standard. It's no longer enough to just say it's a discriminatory impact. You have to prove intent. And so for the Fourth Circuit to find that, it says a lot. This will be our first election presidential in 50 years without the key protections of the Voting Rights Act. That court case is monumental.
We're talking with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, who joins us from New Haven today. Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we're going to talk about the latest into the federal grand jury investigation into campaign funds that benefited Governor Dan Malloy during the last election cycle. We will also talk a little bit about that term that Mark Cuban used about whether or not we can actually use that on the radio. I have some very thoughtful ideas about that coming up right after this in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil, Connecticut is seen as a leader in criminal justice reform, but that reputation did not put pressure on lawmakers to pass Governor Malloy's second year of reform proposals. We'll find out if Second Chance 2.0 has a future in the upcoming session. We'll take a look at what some Connecticut communities are doing to help ex-offenders reintegrate. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil. And if you're free tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, you can listen in to the debut of my new program. It's called Next, and it's powered by the New England News Collaborative. We've got stories from around New England, and we're going to be talking about what exactly makes a Yankee on tomorrow's show. That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on the brand new program Next. Today in the Wheelhouse, we're talking with Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror and Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, Kalila Brown-Dean, who joins us from the studios of Yale University in New Haven. Quickly, Colin, you mentioned during the last segment about the question whether or not Connecticut is actually a state in play. This is a blue state, or so we're told. Is it actually in play during this presidential campaign?
Paul Manafort, the manager for Trump, dangled that idea this week, saying that they even had polls that said that. I think he's referring to an internal poll for Dan Carter, who's the candidate running against Dick Blumenthal. The problem with internal polls is, you know, people like me and Paz and Kalila can't inspect them to see what the polling science is. So I don't know. It may just be that the electoral map is tightening up for Trump, you know, as he loses, as Colorado and Virginia and places like that slip off the table. Just in order to raise money and stay viable, you got to start making arguments about other states that might be in play. But let me just say one thing, which is I do think that Trump is going to run off economic discontent. And for all the reasons that we've been talking about on the Wheelhouse for years now, Connecticut's economic recovery is lagging behind its neighbors. So it's possible that Massachusetts could go for Clinton by, you know, double-digit margins, and Connecticut could be really close, because I do think when people are economically unhappy, they feel as though they're not sharing in prosperity and recovery. Trump is a much more attractive candidate, so I wouldn't completely write him off here.
Paz?
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans are going to be saying, if you're mad at Dan Malloy, you know, if you want to punch Dan Malloy, vote for Donald Trump. At the margins, that will move some people, but it's really hard to know. You would need the world's most detailed poll to really have a good sense of that, because there's so many cross currents at work here.
There's a poll at Quinnipiac.
How's that for a weasel answer?
I was going to say there's a poll at Quinnipiac University, Kalila. I mean, are we going to find out anything from polls about this, do you think?
Well, let me just say that the QU poll is a separate entity from the university. I have to give that disclaimer.
A little disclaimer, yes, indeed.
Just a disclaimer. But I think there's a long road between now and November. I always feel like we're one national tragedy or public gaffe away from people completely changing the person for whom they intend to vote.
We were talking about the discontent that many Connecticut residents have about the economy. It's shown up in poll numbers that we've seen for Governor Daniel Malloy. Something that probably doesn't help his poll numbers is now a federal grand jury is looking into the state Democratic Party and whether or not they violated campaign finance laws in funding Governor Malloy's 2014 campaign. The latest details in this, Paz, seem to have subpoenas going out to Democratic Party officials and also to state contractors.
Well, that's the question. I mean, the State Elections Enforcement Commission investigation was an attempt to find out how did the party come to target state contractors? To what extent was the governor involved, people in his administration involved, and did that run afoul of the public financing program, because you do have to make certain promises when you accept that money? So it's not surprising that that's where the feds are going. The thing that's really interesting about this is the feds came in and started this investigation after there was really this open appeal by two former FBI agents, you know, Mike Clark, who had led the Roland investigation, and Charlie Urso, who not only played a key role in the Roland investigation — we're talking about the first one, I guess we have to specify — but Charlie was the investigator on elections enforcement. That was his second career. So, you know, Deirdre Daly, the U.S. Attorney for Connecticut, said, "Okay, let's go look at this." So this is gonna keep a cloud over Governor Malloy for a question of months. And the other factor is, if Hillary Clinton is elected, and if Dan Malloy was going to make a short list for any cabinet post, if this thing is still pending, I think you're going to see Governor Malloy sticking around Connecticut for a good long while.
Yeah, Colin, I'm just wondering, does it work this way? Can you just pay a fine to the FBI, like $300,000 or so, and just make the investigation go away?
No, and that, as Paz is suggesting, this that may have actually – I mean, federal grand juries sit for 18 months, so they were already there. And so it's a short walk for Deirdre Daly, the U.S. attorney, across the street to say, hey, you know what? It looks like maybe the state isn't going to deal with this, and we may have to double down on whatever it was that we were going to do anyway. I think – let's assume that something bad happened. We don't know that, but let's assume that something bad happened just for the sake of argument. And the real question becomes, how familiar are the contractors who are being subpoenaed and perhaps some of the state officials with the concept of omerta? Because, you know, in certain circumstances, you don't tell anybody nothing, even if you get subpoenaed, even if you have to risk perjury charges. If somebody asks you, well, did they say, you know, Governor Malloy would be really grateful for your contribution? And, you know, you say, I don't remember anything about that. You know, but if you're a contractor, I don't know. I mean, would you do that? So to me, anyway, it may boil down. If anything bad happened — we don't know that anything bad happened, but if anything did, omerta will be very important.
Kalila?
Well, I agree. It's really difficult at this point to see who's responsible versus who will take the fall for this if something does come out of it. But I think it raises these continuing questions we're talking about at the national level about trust, accountability, and transparency, and what this will mean for how people in Connecticut feel about the government they have.
And I wonder, Paz, does this play out at all in any of the down-ticket races coming up, anything having to do with the state legislature? I mean, obviously, state Republicans have been trying to make hay about this for quite some time. With everything else going on in the world, I don't know how much the public is listening.
The answer to a lot of questions, if you're a Republican running for office, it's going to be Dan Malloy on all kinds of reasons. Probably the more potent of the things hanging over him is the economy, is the budget. And that's what the Republicans are going to be using. That's what they have been using. This is more icing on the cake because unless you were a major fundraiser for the Democrats, again, I think it's going to be more budget and economy and Dan Malloy you'll be hit with that way.
So let me just finish with this. Colin had tried to put this word into a Hartford Current column, not exactly sure that it could work. The word is jagoff. We heard Mark Cuban, a Pittsburgh native, say it earlier. It's going to come up a lot during this presidential campaign because Pennsylvania is so important. Here's the usage. It's Scots-Irish, and it basically goes back to a root of, I'm jagging you, Paz. I'm teasing you a little bit. So the way you use it is, yinz is all a bunch of jagoffs. And that's how Mark Cuban used it, and that's how you can use it as well. You can find out more in The Wheelhouse coming up next week. Thanks for joining us.